The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Welcome to theflypod.com and another story on the fly. I'm your host, Dr. John M. Cutter. And if it sounds like we're not coming to you from our usual plush digs in the De Silver Studios, it's because I'm currently in the city of Capas in the Republic of the Philippines with approximately 1,000 individuals from the military, citizenry, scout troops, all here celebrating the Capas Freedom March and the survivors and the memories of those who perished in the Bataan Corregidor March.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Philippine National Anthem. Up!
Ha ha ha. with elements of the Philippine Navy, Army, and Air Force, along with the 3rd Division of the United States Marines from Okinawa, we're doing a few warm-up calisthenics. It's 5 a.m. after an hour and a half drive from Metro Manila, and these people are just about to embark on a 10-kilometer memorial march, marking again those who sacrificed and died, many of them, in the Bataan Death March, and those who followed them in the surrender of Corregidor. Of the 60 to 80,000 individuals from the U.S. Army, Allies, and Philippine forces during World War II who made that march, approximately 6,000 perished. We're speaking with Dr. Mina Gabor, the former Secretary of Tourism for the Republic of the Philippines and one of the principal organizers of today's march. Dr. Gabor, can you tell us a little bit about the significance of today's march and what it means?
First, it's really a remembrance. And in fact, our theme is Remember the Sacrifice. So we wanted to make sure that people are actually using the sacrifices of our forefathers to build on the peace and freedom. So we did not call this a death march, but a celebration of peace.
Excellent.
And I think it's the only march that's dedicated to peace.
Excellent. I'm with Kantaro Suzuki, who is a reporter from Japan. And Kantaro, your newspaper again is?
Daily Manila Shimbun, local newspaper here in Manila.
In Manila. And what brings you to the Capiz Freedom March?
Well, to attend and witness this march, since this is a very memorial year, because this is the 70th year.
The 70th year, yes. And your readership is mostly here in the Philippines or in Japan as well?
Well, mostly the Philippines here, the Metro Manila.
Metro Manila. Yeah. And to just show you what a small world it is, our reporter, Mr. Suzuki, happened to attend what university?
Wittenberg University in Ohio.
In Ohio. Yeah. So it's a small world here in the middle of the tropics. It's 6:15 now, and the sun is fully up. I've bailed out of the presidential Jeep. And again, even though my intention was to walk the whole 10 kilometers, when a past president of a nation asks you to ride, what else can you do? But nevertheless, I wanted to have an opportunity to speak to other marchers today. We're at the 4th kilometer. Each kilometer is marked with signage that documents the history of this walk. At this point, we're at April 9th with the forces of U.S. General Edward King Jr. crippled by starvation and disease. At that point, they surrendered approximately 75,000 troops at Bataan. Throughout the march, the city of Capiz streets have been lined with onlookers, people waving, members of the military and police force saluting the past president, and members of the military and the marchers today for this first Capiz Freedom March. Well, we're past the 5-kilometer mark now, and it is just about 6:45. And I guess in the sake of full disclosure, I should tell the listeners that I am just a month shy of 63. I weigh about 206 pounds. I'm in very good health, no past histories, but for all intents and purposes, I'm fit and able to make these kind of walks. And at least I've got a marching band behind me to keep pace. So that's in stark contrast, I know, to the young men who originally made this march, starting out at Maravillas and going all the way to Camp O'Donnell, almost 100 kilometers away. For Everett Reamer and his boys from Corregidor, they went 25 kilometers once they hit the waterline to Cabanatuan. Their average age was 22. And unlike myself, who is dressed in a pair of cargo shorts and cross trainers and a commemorative t-shirt, they wore boots, full-length utilities, long-sleeve shirts, and some were even forced to wear their helmets on the march, which in 90-degree heat and 95-98% humidity is true torture. As much as I was intending to march the whole 10 kilometers, I was invited to ride in a Jeep with His Excellency Fidel Ramos, the past President of the Republic of the Philippines.
And General MacArthur.
And General MacArthur, who's our driver. Mr. President, can you tell me a little bit about what today's march means and your impression of it?
Thank you. We would like to address this to all veterans, not just in the Philippines and in the U.S., but also around the world. The most important message I'd like to bring to all of you, especially the young ones, is that let us now prevent and avoid war. Because has been the experience of the Americans and the Filipinos who fought in World War II and thereafter in a countrywide guerrilla resistance movement for 4 years. War is so cruel, it's so punishing, and it is undesired by everybody, including the soldiers. It is in fact the soldiers and their families that suffer the most when there is conflict, when there is war, when there is violence. And so in our time, and this is 73 years after Bataan and Corregidor and Capas, which is our national prisoner of war shrine, in where 30,000 Americans and Filipinos died from disease, hunger, and maltreatment, let us now ambition for a better, more bountiful future where there is no more war. That is the message this is all about, and we hope that we will continue.
Excellent.
To push it and year after year among the younger people everywhere around the world.
And you are currently what age?
I am 87.
And what do you remember about the war in that period of time?
Well, I am a veteran of the Korean and Vietnam Wars with 42 years in the military service, attaining the rank of full general with 4 stars. But I am the first one to tell you, in our armed forces of the Philippines and all the veterans from our country, that war is no longer an option. Our ambition must be for enduring peace and sustainable development everywhere. And if we understand how lethal World War III could be, that is 1,000 times more deadly than the atom bombs dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima over Japan 73 years ago.
And I think probably there are any number of our listeners in the United States who don't realize that after Warsaw, Manila in the Philippines was the second most destroyed city during the Second World War.
That is correct. But in terms of the whole country, in a population of 16 million in 1942, we lost 1 million people. And on an average, proportionally, that is the single biggest proportional loss of any country, except for Germany during World War II.
And many Americans don't realize that the American cemetery here in the Philippines is the largest military U.S. cemetery outside of Arlington and Washington, D.C. as well. So the United States has had a very strong bond throughout its history with the Republic of the Philippines.
That is correct. And we hope the younger people around from the Philippines, the U.S. and elsewhere can visit all of these shrines, because they're more than just homages or tributes to our heroic veterans and war dead. but they are reminders to all of us young people that war must be prevented and avoided. That is why we have the United Nations. That is why we have leaders who think in a more modern and liberal way, unlike 73 years ago.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm just a few yards away from the 6 kilometer marker, and I've just passed a small white washed obelisk with the silhouette of a soldier supporting a failing soldier. And it simply has on it its inscription, 108 kilometers. You do the math. But just a very quiet, almost hidden testimony of the unconquerable faith of all of these men. So I'm here with Nestor Ibarra. He was one of our drivers in the presidential Jeep entourage this morning. And Nestor, tell us a little bit about your backstory and what you're doing here at the march today.
Well, actually, it's part of my passion every now and then joining all these World War II event or ceremony. And I have a lot of passion, you know, collecting war memorabilia or artifacts. And right now, I'm into military Jeep restoration, especially this World War II Willys Jeep from 1941 slot grill to 1945 Model B Willys. I really find joy doing this, especially when I'm meeting World War II survivors, especially Death March survivors. And I really love hearing their stories. And it really pushes me every now and then. Like every now and then that I hear events or they do events like this, I want to get involved.
Mm-hmm. How many Jeeps have you restored?
Actually, I have 14 Jeeps. Right now I'm keeping 7 because I already sold the 7 units because I'm running out of garage. You know, my neighbors were complaining because my Jeeps are parked alongside the road in front of their house sometimes. So, to get rid of my problem with my garage, then I have to sell the half. Right now I have 7.
And how long does it take to restore a Jeep back to working function?
Usually, to make it worthy functioning, it will take you like 8 months to 10 months, but to be sure, maybe 1 year, for as long as you have all the parts you need and you have the time, because restoring Jeep is not that easy. If you're not in the mood, better just sit down. Otherwise, you will just be messing up your restoration.
And you've also had the chance to meet a number of survivors who had made the march from Bataan and some who'd made the march to Cabanatuan from Corregidor. Can you tell us about some of their stories as well?
Yeah. Just this morning, I happened to meet Lieutenant Martel. He survived the death march, and he was telling me the brutality of World War II, how they were treated during the death march. Imagine, you have to fit in one couch, and regardless how many you are, you have to push in yourselves because you cannot do anything about it, because at your back, there is this sharp bayonet by these Japanese soldiers, and they will keep on pushing you with their bayonets, and you will have to fill in or jump back the train coach. And when you have the chance to escape, and somebody or these Japanese soldiers will see you, they'll let you escape anyway. But somewhere along your escape route, when you are already tired, they will run after you with their horse. It's either they will shoot you right there, or they will let you dig your own graveyard, then shoot you. Then when you fall on your graveyard, they will keep on stabbing you with their bayonet. It's very brutal.
Horrible story.
Yeah, horrible
story.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Nestor.
Thank you.
So we're at the end of our 10 kilometers, and I'm standing here talking to Captain Murphy and Lieutenant Chenoweth of the...
Headquarters Battalion, 3rd Marine Division.
In?
Okinawa, Japan.
Okinawa. And what brings the Marine Corps to the Kapas Freedom March today?
Well, we are here supporting the Army unit out of TRADOC, and we're here for Balikatan, supporting that exercise. So we just happened to be on deck at the same time this march was going on, and they were generous enough to invite us as their guests.
So, Lieutenant, is this an elective, or was this an order?
Oh, no, this is voluntold, so.
Okay. And you jogged all the way, because 10 clicks is just a walk in the park for you guys, right?
Absolutely, especially when it's all uphill.
Absolutely. So what did this day mean to you? How old are you, by the way, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh, boy. I am 33.
Just a baby. And Lieutenant?
26, sir.
26, okay. And I'm a month shy of 63, so if I made it, you had to make it. So this was long before your time, certainly, but what does it mean as a member of the U.S. Armed Forces to be here?
Well, I mean, there's so much history in the Philippines, and I've had the opportunity to come to the Philippines. This is my second time supporting exercises down here, and it's great to be able to partner with the Armed Forces of the Philippines. And I've learned a lot of history from the first visit we had down here during FIBLEX last fall, and it's really just continued. We were able to actually come to the shrine here in Capiz last October, so learned a lot more about our history, and it's something that's good to constantly remind ourselves so no one forgets what happened here.
Absolutely. Lieutenant, anything to add?
Just to say it was a privilege to march with the troops during the event, and it's a privilege to be here.
Well, thank you for your service, and God bless. Semper Fi.
Bye.
By all means. Thank you. Lieutenant?
I'll give this back to
give
you.
Give me my Buckeye. There's one other piece of equipment that I'm carrying today. I'm not carrying a canteen of water because almost all of those who walked didn't. Many tried to steal water out of the ruts of carabao tracks and wagon wheel ruts. Carabaos are the local water buffalo that inhabits this region. Instead, I have a 3x5 plastic photo case that's suspended around my neck with a red lanyard. And in it, I have three photographs. The first is of a fresh-faced 16-year-old boy in his army utilities, smiling broadly, standing in front of a painted canvas that represents airplanes overflying army tents. And the date on the bottom of the photo is July 1941, Corregidor. This is Everett D. Reamer. And if you haven't heard Everett's story or read his book on conquerable faith, I would recommend you do so. A three-part series can be found on theflypod.com, and it should be required reading or listening for all of us. The other photo is a historic Japanese propaganda photo of the surrender of the Allies from the west end of Malinta Tunnel on Corregidor. And in the center of that crowd of men being taken as POWs, you'll see a dirty, sandy-haired, 17-year-old Everett Reamer. And the other photo that I carry is a color photo from just a few years ago of Everett and three of his POW veterans, among them Dick Francis, Malcolm Adams, and Chuck Town, at the dedication of the Hellship Memorial at Subic Bay, not too terribly far from where I'm marching today. And when people come up to me and ask me why I'm marching, I show them these photos and tell the story of a 17-year-old boy who quickly became a man, who became a soldier and a POW, and eventually, after an entire war of being held in captivity and privation and brutality, is someone who has provided peace and security in his own dimension to all of us and has become a robust, positive, productive human being. So Everett, for you, the survivors, and all of the sacred dead whose memories we remember, this is for you. It's after the march, and we're considering whether or not the sacrifice was worthwhile, or if the price was too great. And I'm sitting here talking to Nora Eustaquio Santos. In June, Nora will be 90 years old. and I'm asking her to reminisce a little bit about not the time of the death march or the fall of Corregidor, but just before the end of the war, when the Allies hit Leyte Gulf and the Japanese knew that their time in the Philippines was at an end. So, Nora, what do you remember most?
I remember most is when we were on our march outside San Mateo, because the Japs were they didn't know what to do then. There were planes, you know, hovering around, but we didn't know what was it, you know. But we had to go. We had to go to La Mesa Dam, Joy. We had to evacuate to La Mesa Dam. On our way out of the war front, the front where the Japanese were, you know, we had to go to, that is about, La Mesa Dam is, it was a long way. That during that time. Mm-hmm. And that is where the Americans were. The first American we saw just looked like a god. Everybody was, you know, was asking, how it's so happy to see you. We've been waiting for you for a long time. And then there was this old lady, my aunt, and she had something on her hands, peanuts or something. She was trying to feed the guard those peanuts, you know. Mm. She didn't know what to give him because of the joy in her heart, you know.
And San Mateo is a north by northeast community outside of Metro Manila, today about 18-20 kilometers away. Mm-hmm. And when you evacuated from San Mateo, what did you take with you? Anything?
What we took were the easiest things to carry, like sugar, like maybe not even rice, because rice you have to cook.
Yeah.
We just had a bowl full of sugar, so that any time that we are hungry, we can just stop and take some water and sugar. Mm-hmm. That is how, I think that is how we survived during that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is until we walked to the dam.
To the dam.
And every people we meet, it's just one cigarette away. You just keep on walking. It's just, another one would say, it's just two cigarettes away.
Two cigarettes.
And she didn't know what to do.
And meaning, the time that it took you to smoke a cigarette was how close it
was. Okay. That's how it does. We were talking to those Filipino farmers. That's how they, the distance, that's how they did it with the distance. One cigarette away, two cigarettes away.
And then how long was the length of the evacuation? How long did you have to stay away from San Mateo before you were able to come back in?
I think about 4 or 5 days.
4 or 5 days.
Yes.
So fairly quickly. I mean, the evacuation took place and then Manila was resecured at that point.
Yes, yes.
And then the fighting took place more to the north. Okay. So what else do you remember about those days before the evacuation?
I remember when we were in the evacuation center, our co-Filipinos, they were able to catch a Japanese who was in disguise, who wanted to go with us out front, you know. And somebody was asking me, "You want to see us behead him?" Oh no, who would want to see somebody behead somebody? Well, anyway, that one. And another one is when we met an American pilot. It's a 21-year-old boy, the pilot. I think he crashed in somewhere there in the vicinity. And you know, everybody, he's just like a dad, a god also, you know. Such a cute boy.
And your dad, your father had been imprisoned during the war.
When we were here.
When you were here in San Mateo.
Oh.
Yeah, but he was also, during the war, he was a dean of a college of dentistry,
yes,
too.
Yes.
And he was helping students undercover, basically, come in and still get their education, even while the Japanese occupation was going on.
And I even remember that there was a guerrilla coming to the house.
So when the Japanese came to get him, I was really scared because I knew he was seeing somebody. So they took him. He was incarcerated for about a month.
10 months, okay. And you had family that also was in the Bataan death march too.
Yes. The brother of my father.
Okay.
Yeah, but he survived. He survived, and he said, if I get out of this mess, I'm going to go to that march for the Nazarene in Quiapo.
And for listeners in the United States, the march and the festival of the Black Nazarene is a huge outpouring of supporters and believers in the Catholic religion who meet every February, I believe.
Yes.
And this year's celebration was host to over a million people coming together to celebrate the ritual of the Black Nazarene. Oops.
The people that came for the Black Nazarene, it's a huge, huge crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge, huge crowd.
And that was his oath that he made, that if he survived the death march, he would make the March of the Black Nazarene. Excellent.
In memory of all American and Filipino soldiers from this chapter of history, a landmark now stands in the province of Tarlac. It is known as the Capas National Shrine, or Pagonita sa Capas. The shrine is 54 hectares, approximately 25 acres, of parkland. On its center is a 70-meter obelisk surrounded by a black marble wall on which lay inscribed the names of all those who died as a result of the death march. And walking toward that shrine via the long corridor of pavement, bordered on both sides by an honor guard of flags, you will find yourself instantly in touch with the obligation to all those souls. There were two interviews that we were not able to bring to you on this podcast. One was the commanding officer of the U.S. Marines from Okinawa, Colonel Taylor. When I thanked him for the opportunity to interview two of his officers, Captain Murphy, a graduate of the University of Virginia, and Lieutenant Chenoweth, a Naval Academy at Annapolis grad, he confided with pride to me that these young people are some of the best and brightest I've seen. Think of that. And then think how many of our best and brightest we lost during that time. And how many of our best and brightest are still willing to stand up in our defense. The other interview was with a young member of the Philippine Girl Scouts. She was 13, and without a parent to give consent, I couldn't in good conscience air her interview. But I asked her what freedom meant to her. And after a few seconds of embarrassment, she replied, "Freedom is doing the right thing. And maybe it boils down to something just that simple. Freedom is the ability and courage to see something wrong and make it right, as well as to see something right and be willing to fight to defend it, preserve it, and transmit it unsullied to future generations. And to remember the cost of that freedom resonating in names such as Brandywine, Antietam, Gettysburg, Belleau Wood, Normandy, Point de Hoc, Saint Lô, Incheon, Tet, the Mekong Delta, to Crete, Kabul, and yes, Bataan and Corregidor. Today's Capas Freedom March was 10 kilometers. That's 6.2 miles for you listeners in the U.S. But keep in mind that that was less than half of what Everett Reamer and the POWs from Corregidor marched, and merely one-tenth of the march made by those from Bataan. How do you feel after a 10-kilometer hike commemorating the courage and sacrifice of the men who were part of the Bataan Corregidor death march? Deeply humble for the freedom that they bequeathed to each of us. So the next time you meet a veteran or a wounded warrior, whether American or Filipino or the like, shake their hand, give them a hug, thank them for their service, because they fought for something more than country or flag or cause. They fought for freedom. They fought for you. And like President Ronald Reagan once said, the price for this freedom at times has been high, but we have never been unwilling to pay the price. And to those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, well, they just don't know where to look. The march is done now, and I'm back in my condominium overlooking Metro Manila from 25 stories up. Today, it's a massive city of high-rise commercial and residential buildings, but 73 years ago, Manila, the Pearl of the Orient, and the three-month Battle of Bataan had fallen to the Japanese Imperial Army during World War II. Beginning April 5th to the 11th, with the fall of Bataan, and a month later, in May, with the fall of Corregidor, 60 to 80,000 Filipino and American prisoners of war were stripped of their weapons and valuables and told to march to Balanga, the capital of Bataan. We in the United States would come to call it the Bataan-Corregidor Death March. Here, in the Republic of the Philippine Islands, it's known as the Marcha ng Kamatayan sa Bataan. Over 100 kilometers in length, the first major atrocity occurred when some 350 to 400 Filipino officers and NCOs were summarily executed after they had surrendered near the Patingang River. POWs received little food or water, and some died along the way from heat or exhaustion. Once the surviving prisoners arrived in Balanga, the overcrowded conditions and poor hygiene caused dysentery and other diseases to rapidly spread. The Japanese failed to provide the prisoners with medical care, leaving U.S. medical personnel to fend for the sick and wounded with few or no supplies. They were beaten. They were starved as they marched. Some were harassed with random bayonet stabs and beatings. Those who fell were bayoneted to death. Some of those who fell were beheaded by Japanese officers who were practicing with their samurai swords from horseback. The Japanese soldiers at that time felt that they were dealing with subhumans and animals because the Japanese culture reflected the view that any warrior who surrendered had no honor, thus was not to be treated like a human being. Trucks drove over some of those who fell or succumbed to fatigue, and so-called cleanup crews put to death those too weak to continue. Although there were some stories of trucks picking up individuals who might have been too fatigued to continue. Still, about 10,000 Filipino and 1,000 American prisoners of war died before they could reach their destination. From San Fernando in the province of Pampanga, the prisoners were transported by rail to Capas. 100 or more prisoners were stuffed into each of the train's boxcars, known as 40 and 8s, because they could either accommodate 40 men or 8 horses comfortably. All were unventilated and sweltering in the tropical heat. The trains had no sanitation facilities, and disease continued to take a heavy toll on the prisoners. After they reached Capas, they were forced to walk the final 9 miles to Camp O'Donnell. Even after arriving at Camp O'Donnell, the survivors of the march continued to die at rates of up to several hundred per day, leading to about 2,500 American and as many as 25,000 Filipino dead. Most of the dead were buried in mass graves the Japanese dug. Said one unidentified POW, "Hell was a state of mind. Camp O'Donnell was a place." It was not until January 27, 1944, that the U.S. government informed the American public about the march when it released sworn statements of military officers who had escaped from the march. Shortly thereafter, the stories of these officers were featured in a Life magazine article. And, in an attempt to counter the American fury and the propaganda value of the march, the Japanese had the Manila Times claim that the prisoners were treated humanely and their death rate had been attributed to the intransigence of the American commanders, who did not surrender until their men were on the verge of death. The general of the Japanese army, Masaharu Homma, in September of 1945, was arrested by Allied troops and indicted for war crimes. The general claimed that he had been so absorbed in his efforts to capture Corregidor after the fall of Bataan and the transfer of POWs to the camp at Cabanatuan that he had remained ignorant of the high death toll of the death march until 2 months after the event. He was sentenced to death by firing squad and was executed on April 3, 1946, outside Manila. And it was not until September 13, 2010, that Japanese Foreign Minister Katsuya Okada apologized to a group of six former American soldiers who during World War II were held as prisoners of war by the Japanese, including 90-year-old Lester Tenney and Robert Rosendahl, both survivors of the Bataan Death March. Those of you listening to this podcast in New Mexico know that the death march had a large impact on your state as well. Of 1,800 New Mexico soldiers from the 200th and 515th Coast Artillery of the National Guard deployed to the Philippines in World War II, only half survived. And within a few years after the war, almost one half more had died. The New Mexico National Guard Bataan Memorial Museum is located in the armory where the soldiers of the 200th and 515th were processed before their deployment to the Philippines in 1941. Every year in early spring, the Bataan Memorial Death March, a 26.2-mile run and march, is conducted at White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico. As of May 2012, there were only 60 survivors left, 31 of whom still resided in New Mexico. And many of you in Chicago might not realize that the iconic bridge that crosses the Chicago River on your way down Michigan Avenue is dedicated as the Bataan-Corregidor Death March Bridge. I'm John M. Cutter for theflypod.com and Stories on the Fly. Thanks for listening.